good. Okay. Part two, everybody. Welcome. We'll get started. Just want to make a couple quick announcements. Learning today, sort of on Torah Motions, being dedicated to the memory of her, Rav David Ben Yaakov Yisrael, on Rabbi Bernard Mandelbaum on his 20th Yahrzeit. It's a learning for today. And of course, at 1 p.m. This afternoon, we'll be interviewing Shira Mervis on her recent appointment as the Rosh Kehillah of Beit Knesset in Efrat. That'll be a different login, but that'll be at 1 p.m. And we look forward to learning with you and all our shiurim. And with that, Rachel, we look forward to your shiur now.
Thank you very much, Rabbi Kalman. Thank you, everybody, for coming. Nice to see some people I recognized from last time, and slowly I'll start recognizing more. Let me just recap very, very briefly so that we're all on the same page, and then we'll delve right in. We talked last week about the beginning of the book of Judges, and we talked about how the biblical storyteller here establishes certain expectations that are supposed to then become our little cute tour guides leading us through the carnage to come. We saw how the beginning hints to us that this is going to be about wars, this is going to be about bloodshed, this is going to be about leadership. And it seemed for one glorious moment as if this was going to be the moment when the people grab initiative and become the authors in the sense of their own tale. Because for the first time, they come to God and say, what should we do now? How should we proceed with the project you gave us, which is a project of conquering and settling the land? And almost immediately, they fail. The first maybe failure, and this is a question of interpretation, is when they ask who shall rise first for us, and God says Yehuda, and instead of understanding that as Yehuda will lead all the people to fight all their wars and all their various allotted pieces of land, Yehuda takes it to mean I will fight my war first, and then washes his hand as a tribe from everything else, from all the other tribes' trouble. But then we see that one tribe after another has difficulty conquering certain lands. And it seems as if the story is going to be a story of there was a goal, they failed to reach it, then they rallied and they overcame. But God intervenes and changes a trajectory. God says, you know that problem that in a normal story would be the conflict that you have to overcome to reach a happy ending? No. This is a sin, and the punishment or the consequence of this sin is that it'll remain with you always. You will never succeed to overcome this conflict. Your story is not going to be the story of fully conquering the land and living happily ever after, but rather the story of constantly living in strife with other ethnic group, surrounded by the temptation of their idolatry and the threat of their might, and how you deal with it will be the story, how you live through it. And we saw already in the beginning a sort of declaration of the pattern of the story to come. We were told that time and time again, the people will sin. As a result, God will allow the other nations around them to overcome them. They will oppress them, tax them, enslave them, rob them. At some point, the people will call out in distress to God, like the Jews called out in Egypt. God will have mercy and send Moshiach, someone who can redeem, save them, what we call shofet, a leader, a judge. Judge is a little bit misleading because judge in our world is very much tied to the judicial role and less so to a military leadership, which is more of what it implies in the most basic sense here. And then the judge dies, the judge saves them, the judge dies, and once again, they forgot God and sin. All of this was established within the first few chapters of the book of Judges. Today, we will see how that pattern actually plays out through the middle section of the book of Judges. But before we do that, I want to ask a more general question about storytelling. And this will be a question that we will grapple with first in theory and then with the text itself. We said last time, we said in many iterations, really, that if a story were to just be, for example, a recording of an hour in a cafe, it wouldn't feel like a story. For it to feel like a story, for it to give us meaning, some things need to be highlighted, some things need to draw our attention. We need to have certain interpretive keys We need to know what we're looking for so that our experience of it will be more structured, more focused, and allow us to experience whatever the process, the magical process is that leads people through stories and make them feel like, wow, this came together. This meant something for us. And the question is, how do you do it? We said about how you do it in the beginning. We talked about how you do it in the beginning by creating certain expectations, by creating certain trajectories in the mind of the reader. But when you're already in the middle of a story, how does a storyteller draw the attention of the reader, the listener, the audience to particular details over other details? How do you highlight something? And I'd like to open it for this question to you. If anybody wants to unmute themselves and suggest something or share it in the chat, I will read it out loud. Just briefly, any thoughts? If you were a storyteller, yes, Norm Finkelberg says, by introducing the unexpected. This is a very important point because it's true. Surprises make us respond, make us sit up and pay attention. But I have to ask a question about that. I once read this wonderful book about the psychology of toddlers, and it's called The Scientist in the Crib, about how children process the world and build certain terms, certain tools for understanding the world. And the author pointed out that for a one-year-old sitting in their high chair at the dinner table, if their father would suddenly sprout wings and start flying above them, that would not be surprising. Because for a one-year-old, everything that's happening is kind of different and unique and special. And every day they notice something different, right? So in order for something to be surprising, it's not enough for it to be outlandish. It needs to be surprising in terms of the text. So how do you make something surprising, in your opinion? Or how do you highlight something if you have a different suggestion?
So I think indeed you have to set, I mean, certainly in the books that I read, you have to set the context, you have to set what normal is, mm-hmm. and then you can move toward the unusual. Why am I even telling this story?
That's a really good point, because, and it's like, to use a different example, if you see a flying horse in a fantasy book, it's not very surprising. It's just par for the course, right? That's part of the background. Whereas if you read a Shakespeare play and it establishes itself with some kind of gritty, grim realism a la Hamlet, and then there's a flying, well, Hamlet is maybe not a good example, but, and then there's a flying horse, then that's surprising. Norm Finkelberg added, behavior inconsistent with the character we have been introduced to, which is another a variation on the same answer. Epi wrote, various literary tricks are used. Repetition of a word in a unit works in introducing Mordechai. Sorry, there's some problem here. In Esther, the root for exile, galut, gala, is repeated four times, leitmotif words. So I'm glad you wrote that, Epi, because you're pointing out something very important, which is all the examples I gave before were plot elements. What you're pointing out is that even word choices create a certain sense of both of what normal and what you need to pay attention to, what things are important by emphasizing, by repeating them, by kind of coming over and over again and hitting us over the head with them. By the way, somebody wrote here, I can't tell who it is, you could use the Joseph Campbell archetypes, which is an excellent point, and I'll come back to that in a bit. I'll explain what it is and come back to it in a bit. I want to pause for a second and point out that all the different answers that were given here, in a sense, rely on the same technique, which is repetition, in various ways. But how do you establish what's normal in a story? By having certain things, I'll take a step back and I'll explain what I mean. Repetition can be used in two ways. One way, and this goes with what Epi wrote about words that repeat themselves, leitmotifs, words or motifs or anything that repeats itself over and over again. So the repetition in this case lays an emphasis on something because it hits us over the head with whatever it is. It keeps coming back to the same thing, and it's almost like a flashing light. You know, it's like you see the word once, you don't pay attention. You see the flying horse once, you don't pay attention. But then you see it over and over and over again. And at some point, your mind as the audience realizes that there's a pattern here. And the way our mind works is that when we see a pattern, we need to understand it. We want to understand why it's significant. We pay attention to it. The next time a flying horse shows up, we will notice because we already have our eyes open to notice that appearance. So that's a way that repetition emphasizes things by repeating them. Sorry, not very elegant sentence. But the other way that repetition is important is because it establishes what normal is. And then you can have break away from the normal. Then something can be surprising, as Naomi Baryam said, surprising in terms of the context of the story itself. Not something that's surprising in our world, not something that's gonna go over our head, but rather something we expect something, and then the frustration of this expectation draws our attention. You know how in fairy tales, often the pattern is three suitors want to marry the princess. The first did something and failed. The second did something and failed. The third did something and succeeded. So we're geared as audiences, we're geared to pay attention to the moment when the pattern breaks, but we can't reach that moment if there wasn't a pattern to start with. I'd like to share with you the way two scholars who I already quoted last time, David Gunn and Donna Fewell, describe that effect, the effect of repetition in storyteller, in a very good book called The Narrative in the Hebrew Bible. It's in source one, in box one. If meaning, as many say, essentially depends on difference, then sorting out similarity and difference is a central operation of close reading. Repetition creates rich possibilities of variation, and variation creates new meaning. In other words, by repeating over and over again and giving us a sense of what are the normal to be expected things, we're also drawn to notice what are the things that change either suddenly or with every variation. Repetition can first lull the reader into false expectations, and then through sudden variance can introduce an element of startling surprise. Repetition and variation can equate and contrast events or characters or even whole other texts through association, inviting the reader to consider the significance of similarities and dissimilarities. In meetings we're going to have in 2 weeks, I think. Yes, we're going to be talking about Megillat Rut, and we will see indeed how similarities between entire stories serve to draw our attention to certain meanings. But that's not really what we're going to talk about now. I just want to read another comment here from somebody with an iPad. Sorry, I don't see a name. You can also take pieces of existing stories for that culture and rearrange them and add one or two new elements and or turn some existing motifs and turn them on their heads, take and turn. This is a very good point. And Robert Alter, who is a great scholar of narrative in the Bible, the way the stories are written, and recently published the entirety of the Hebrew Bible, a very beautifully literary translation. I'm sure some of you have some knowledge of it, some acquaintance with it. He talks about a thing called type scenes, which is certain scenes that are typical. They come to like a certain segment of events that come together at certain points in the Bible. For example, many betrothal scenes in the Hebrew Bible happen by a well. There's a meeting by a well. In that meeting, somebody gives water to somebody else. In that meeting, somebody rushes. There's some rush, there's some hurry. Now, beyond the fact that there's a lot of symbolism, almost psychoanalytical symbolism in that, because if we think about it, wells can be a symbol of fertility, of water that comes and gives life to the next generation, and the opening of the well allows life to go forth. There's also the fact that these motifs repeat themselves in the marriage of Yitzhak and Rivka, and later Yaakov and Rachel, and later Moshe and Zipporah, give us a certain normal template, which is there's a meeting by a well, somebody gives water to somebody, and somebody rushes, but then also allows us to notice all the differences between the different scenes. And by noticing those differences, we're able to learn important things about the relationship of Yitzhak and Rivka, Yaakov and Rachel, Moshe and Zipporah, as distinct and very, very different relationships. But this is not, we're not going to go there now. I just wanted to say that this is an excellent point, that sometimes the repetition is not even within one story unit, but rather between very, very distant story units within the Hebrew Bible or within a culture in general. But let's stop talking in theory and let's go into the book of Judges and see how repetition is used within intertextual, yes, how repetition is used particularly in this book. And first and foremost, the thing that repeats itself, as we said already, as is well known, is this pattern of sin, oppression, calling out, a redeemer showing up, victory, and forgetfulness and sin again. Let's call it a six-stage cycle. You can analyze it a little bit differently if you wish, but this is the overall, this is a cycle. This is a repetition that we see over and over and over again through almost the entirety of the book of Judges. And this repetition lays emphasis on things in two ways, in the two ways we discussed. First, by kind of hitting us over the head with certain ideas that repeat over and over again and kind of leave us unable to not notice them, but also by establishing a certain normal and therefore allowing us to notice the differences between one variation to the next, to the next, to the next. But let's talk about the similar first. As we already mentioned last time, but let's look at it together again. And I am now in box number 2 in the source sheet. It's in the first page here. There's a connection that the repetition makes, this pattern that we see over and over again, the sin, enslavement, etc., makes a connection between the sin and the punishment. Let's read together Judges 3, 5 to 6. This is not the first story of enslavement. I just chose it because it's very clear here. The Israelites settled among the Canaanites, Hittites, Amorites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites. They took their daughters to wife and gave them their own daughters to their son, and they worshiped their gods. In Hebrew, the word that's used here is ve'ya'avdu et Elokehem. The root is ayin bet dalet, to work, to worship, to be a slave of. And then we see when the punishment comes, a few verses later, the Israelites again did what was offensive to the Lord. And because they did what was offensive to the Lord let King Eglon of Moab prevail upon Israel, over Israel. Eglon brought the Ammonites and the Amalekites together under his command and went and defeated Israel and occupied the city of Palms. The Israelites were subject to King Eglon of Moab for 18 years. Were subject in Hebrew is vayaavdu. Again, the same exact word, just like they worshipped vayaavdu, the gods of the other nations. Now they find themselves being the avadim and the worshippers of, not worshippers, but the slaves, the servants of a political entity. Leaving God, in other words, means that God leaves them and allows someone else to take control over their lives. The question, I guess, that everybody has to ask when they face that is why? Why is it so important to the book of Judges to emphasize through repetition this connection between the sin of worshiping other gods and the result, the consequence of being enslaved by other nations. Does anybody have any thoughts they'd like to share before we delve into some of the some particular implications? Feel free to speak up. Otherwise, I'll look in the chat.
Maybe other gods don't have real power, so worshiping them is basically like just worshiping the people who came up with them.
That's a really who was that? Hana?
Yeah.
Thank you. So Hana makes a really interesting point that it's almost, if I had to classify it or categorize the kind of the field of thought you're talking about, is I would say it's a theological point that by drawing us our attention to this pattern, the storyteller here is forcing us to think about what does it even mean to grant an idol power over you, seeing as an idol is not real. It's not something that exists outside of people's minds and ideas and imagination in a sense, or material possessions in the case of actual physical idols. So it's a really interesting theological point. Anybody else wants to add a different idea?
If we go back to words that repeat, you know, mm-hmm. the word Eved, you know, I invade Dalet, we were slaves in Egypt, and then God used that same word is used when we're taken out of Egypt. We become God's
of
Deh Hashem, exactly. And that's not slaves, but right. And so the fact that word is that we've now chosen to leave that position and become of Deh, the idols. Therefore, our punishment. So you see that repetition of that word. Now, this is the result of that: is you now become the of day these the slaves or of these foreign powers, right? Like you've chosen that. Like you, so you see that, and the results of your actions in terms of what you choose to be and what you choose to do.
So I want to unpack what Rebecca said here for two parts. One part is that there's a certain literary choice here to tie this to the story of Egypt. Because it's true that when we talk about slavery in the Bible, the slaveholder is always Egypt. The big thing that hovers above our imagination is always Shi'abud Mitzrayim, being slaves in Egypt. And this is our national story that we tell every Pesach and Leil HaSeder, right? We used to be slave in Egypt and then we came out, and every generation we have to come out again. Every generation we are endangered and have to come out again. And then in a sense, by using the word Eved, the root Eved, to frame both our abandonment of the covenant we made with God when he took us out of Egypt and the consequence, which is becoming slaves again, places the book of Judges in this wider context of the Jewish story, which deepens also the sense of tragedy. Of what it is that we're losing. We're losing the special mission, the special freedom that we associate with the Exodus from Egypt. The other point you made is about responsibility, and I'll come back to that in a second. I just want to read three answers from the chat. Susanna Levine said it's a reminder of Egypt, which goes in line with what Rebecca said. Somebody else wrote, to reinforce the authority of the priests and prophets. I'm not sure what you mean. Would whoever wrote it like to elaborate? Feel free to write it. I'll get back to it later. Harriet wrote, there's the practical too. Once you are in servitude to a people, you are no longer available to serve God, which is it's an interesting observation, because you could argue with that. You could say that you see that people in servitude are able to retain some sort of loyalty to God sometimes, but I do see what you mean, that it's, you choose a master. And when you allow yourself to choose the idols as your master, you set yourself on a certain path that then leaves less and less room for self-determination. Your choices are taken away from you by the one choice you made in the beginning. Somebody wrote, repetition or sound alike are somewhat easier when telling a story out loud. Words have to sound alike, even if they have different roots. Written down is different. This is a contested point among scholars. There's obviously differences between orally transmitted narratives and written narratives, but I would still argue that when we read the Hebrew Bible, because of the way Hebrew uses roots, that every word has roots, it's still, you can sense it, you can feel it. But yes, there's a difference between spoken and written. From Naomi Finkelberg, you get to serve somebody, and what you serve determines your fate. Naomi Charnov wrote, by worshiping other gods, Israel was a traitor to God. I think that's definitely an important point, that it emphasizes the betrayal. Also, I want to pause here and remind you that how did it start? How did this sin of serving other idols started? It didn't start because they were wicked and malicious and said, oh, we don't want God, we want to serve other gods. It started because they forgot. We talked about it a lot last time, that there's an emphasis on the idea of forgetfulness. They forgot that it was God who took them out of Egypt and brought them to Israel. This was the root of their betrayal. And by showing us time and time again how God saves them and takes them out again and repeats, in a sense, the kind of an echo of our redemption, just like they had in Egypt and by coming into Israel. And then they forget again. It emphasizes both the betrayal and the tragedy of it, that generation after generation after generation fail to transmit these hard-learned and hard-earned lessons of that they learned on their own flesh and through their own suffering. They fail to transmit it, thus dooming their own children to experience it again. Somebody wrote, priests or prophets, why repetition of Israel enslaved when worshiping other gods? Out loud, could not all for God more likely in decentralized society? I would latch onto the last point and say, yes, that part of what we see, that it's a decentralized society. And we will see that a little bit when we start looking at texts from Shoftim, that we see how every new iteration of the cycle takes place in a different part of Israel. It's never all of Israel is conquered by a different nation, like in Babylonian exile. It's this tribe suffers intrusion from this tribe, from this nation, and they fight against them. Then that tribe higher up north is suffering intrusion from another nation. But we will get back to that in a second. I have to pause here. The discussion section. I'll get back to your comments later. Just Naomi Bar-Yam, you raised your hand. You wanted to say something? I can't see you.
Yeah, I think you've already raised it at some level, that this theme of slavery or servitude and God's redeeming us and it does. It goes back to Mitzrayim, and it's been with us. It doesn't end at Shoftim. I mean, this is something that we still struggle with. Is that balance and how do we live in a society and still, you know, that has other priorities and other values and still live our values. I mean, that's an ongoing theme.
So I would, first of all, that's a really important point, that it's not just placing it in the context of the biblical broader narrative, it's placing it in the context of our lived experience. It reminds us that we all have experiences we all have experiences of what it means to be Eved, to worship or to be a servant or to dedicate ourselves to something. And sometimes it's by our own choice, and sometimes it's because we are surrounded by people who are pushing us a certain way. And sometimes sometimes it's about what our parents chose. And at some point we lose this choice. Now, I want to add another thing and then we'll continue with the class. And that is until now we talked about somewhat grim implications of the repetition of this, that it's more tragic, that it shows how they lost their choices, how they limited their field of choice. But there is a little bit of light in the darkness because there's also a didactic message that's very, very important to us, I think, hiding here. And the message is that bad consequences don't come out of nowhere. They could have told the story. The ancient Israelites could have framed the story like that. They could have said, we came to Israel. We tried to conquer it. It was really, really difficult. And then bad things just happened to us. That would have been a very epic and sad and tragic tale that would have removed responsibility from the people. And by removing responsibility from the people, it would have also removed the possibility of redemption from their own hands. It would have said the only way to be saved is if God intervenes on your behalf. And even then, you're this weakling. You're this like weak creature without ability to shape your reality. By telling us, no, you failed. You, the Israelites, failed over and over and over again. And that's what brought about each cycle. Your failure, either to worship God or to educate your children and pass on your knowledge properly, it also tells us the opposite. It tells us that if we do it right, we can avoid it. We can start a different path. For all his controversial standing in the public discourse today, the psychologist Jordan Peterson actually dedicated quite a lot of his one of his newer books. I forgot what it's called, but it's about 12. Sorry, I forgot the name right now, but you can look it up. He talked about that. He brings the book of Judges as an example for an uplifting psychological message, which is counterintuitive because this is such a depressing book.
12 rules
for life. Thank you, Rabbi Kalman. It's such a depressing book with so much bloodshed, with so much failure. But what Jordan Peterson emphasized is that the fact that the failure is time and time again tied to human agency and not to just some kind of tragic outcome that comes out of nowhere and people have no control over also means that somewhere down the line, people might rise who will take their agency and take their ability to shape reality and use it for the good. And this is something positive to bear in the back of our mind as we move forward with the book of Judges. I want to move now to the other role that repetition plays in emphasizing things, namely in establishing what's normal and thus allowing us to notice the changes. And what I want to do now is we will look at three of the iterations, three of the repetitions of this pattern in Judges. Very briefly, we're not going to do a very thorough reading of that because we're trying to cover many, many, a lot of ground today. But we're looking to three iterations and we will try to see what changes from one to the next. And what I hope to show you is that it's not just random changes. There's a certain pattern. There's a certain trends in the book of Judges that things get more and more a certain way that you can only see when you notice that in every little iteration of sin, enslavement, redemption, something changes, something becomes more or less a certain way. So let's look at it together. The first case I want to look at with you is actually the second big story of redemption in the book of Judges. And the story is that those Israelite tribes that live close to the Dead Sea, namely Binyamin and to a lesser extent Yehuda. I will show you a map of the tribes to make it more clear. Here we are in the source sheet and box 5. You can see here the Dead Sea. I don't know if you can see it, but I hope you can. And you see that right next to it is the tribe of Judah, and a little bit above it is the tribe of Benjamin. Across the river, across the Jordan River, on the other side of the Dead Sea, the nations of Moab and Ammon rule. And in this particular moment, Eglon, the king of Moab, sends soldiers to the territory of Benjamin and Yehuda, beats them down, and demands taxes from them for many years, 18 years. And now let's read what happens. I am looking in box number 3, Judges 3, 14 to 17. The Israelites were subject to King Eglon of Moab for 18 years. Then the Israelites cried out to the Lord, and the Lord raised up the champion for them, the Benjaminite Ehud son of Gera, a left-handed man. It happened that the Israelites sent tribute to King Eglon of Moab through him. So Ehud made for himself a two-edged dagger, a gomer in length, which he girded on his right side under his cloak. He presented the tribute to King Eglon of Moab. Now Eglon was a very stout man. I didn't bring the rest of the story, but the story is that he tells Eglon he has a message for him. He goes, the guards of Eglon don't notice that Ehud has a sword because they're looking for it on his left side, as anyone right-handed would put the sword on the left side. They don't search his right side, which seems like a very bad oversight in my opinion. And then he basically stabs Eglon, and because Eglon is so fat, the sword goes all the way in, and he runs for it, calls for an army, and beats the Moabites to the point that any retainers they have on the Israelite side of the Jordan runs away, and he regains independence for Israel and teaches Torah and helps the people become righteous again until he dies and it all gets lost and they forget once more what happened. So we see all the normal elements. There's a forgetting God, enslavement, calling to God, redemption, etc. What I want to draw your attention to are two things. First of all, the fact that the Israelites are calling to God themselves, explicitly. It's here in verse 15. Then the Israelites cried out to the Lord. Or in Hebrew, Vayizaku bnei Israel el Hashem, el Adonai. And the other one that I want to point out is that we do not hear God telling Ehud what to do. We're told Vayakem Hashem la'em, that God raised up a champion for them, the Benjaminite Ehud son of Gera, a left-handed man. But we never see a moment where God calls to him from a burning bush, for example. We just see Ehud standing up and doing something, taking initiative. Now let's look at a different story, the next cycle. We are told that the Canaanites higher up north in Israel, I'll show you again on the map. If you look at the map here, you will see, if you look up the Jordan River towards the Sea of Galilee, if you look at the area that's under the tribes of Menashe and Issachar and Zvulun, this is where the Jezreel Valley is in Israel. This is the area where there are big kingdoms of the Canaanites, big cities. It was a relatively flat area, so it was an area where they were able to hold chariots, which also means it was an area where they relatively controlled the Israelites who didn't have the technological advantage to fight them. So in that, they take over there. They again demand a lot of taxation and forced labor from the tribes that live in that area. And the prophetess Dvorah stands up and starts intervening. Let's look at the beginning of the story here again in box number 3. And Judges 4. Deborah, wife of Lapidot, was a prophetess. She led Israel at the time. She used to sit under the palm of Deborah between Ramah and Bethel in the hill country of Ephraim, and the Israelites would come to her for decisions. She summoned Barak, son of Abinoam of Kedesh in Naphtali, and said to him, "The Lord, the God of Israel, has commanded, go, march up to Mount Tabor and take with you 10,000 men, of Naphtali and Zvulun, and I will draw Sisra, Yavin's army commander, with his chariots and his troops towards you up to the Wadi Kishon, and I will deliver him into your hands." I'll give you a spoiler and say that the way it happens is that when the Canaanites set out to fight against Barak's 10,000 men army, God brings a rain that causes the river of Kishon to overflow, the land becomes muddy, the chariots become stuck, and the technological advantage the Canaanites brought into the field is completely taken out of the equation. And because the people, the Canaanites, were not trained to fight without that technological advantage, Barak's army, even though it was the lesser army in numbers, was able to overcome them completely. What I want to point out here is that this time we do not hear the people's yelling directly. We don't hear their call for help. I didn't bring all the description, but if you look later, you'll see that we hear about their suffering, but we don't hear that they're calling to God. And this time it's not someone rising and just doing the right thing. It's a prophetess representing God, instructing someone to do the right thing. She is a human being, but she is not speaking in her own right. She is speaking God's words to a general, telling him to become the redeemer of this generation. The war was a great success, and I'm moving straight on to the next story. This time it's a story that happens at the north of the Jezreel Valley. If I'm again going to look at the map, the whole war we were talking about happened. I wish I was able to highlight within here, but for some reason it's not letting me highlight. But if you look at where Menashe is on the left side, not the Menashe that is not in Transjordan, the Menashe that is between the river and the sea, this was where the great battle of Barak and Dvorah took place. If you look a little to the north, to the area of Issachar, the next battle we're about to see happens there, between Menashe and Issachar, higher up in the Jezreel Valley. And this time, it's tribes from Arabia and Amalekite tribes that and Midianite from Arabia tribes that come all the way from the south every spring when it's time to collect the wheat. They come with their camels, with their tents, just like, you know, like nomadic tribes coming like almost like locusts, and take away all the wheat that the Israelites were able to grow in the year before that. And it happens over and over and over again. And once again, God sends a redeemer. This time I'm going to look in box four, page three, box four. There's a young man, Gid'on, who is doing an important job. He is beating out wheat, getting the seeds of the wheat away from the chaff. Is that how you call it? Chaff in English? The moths? Usually the way you do it is you stand outdoors in a wide open space where you can use the wind to your advantage, because as you beat it, the wind carries out the chaff and the seeds that are heavier fall down, and it's easier to keep it all together. But he's not doing that. He's doing that instead in the wine press, in a place where you step down either on wine, on grapes to create wine, or sometimes on olives to create olive oil, which is an enclosed space. And he's doing it there because anyone beating wheat outside where those tribes can see them is basically dooming himself to be robbed. He's trying to hide whatever little wheat they were able to grow that year by doing the work in an unusual, unexpected, enclosed space. And then God intervenes. And this time, it's not Gid'on coming out of his own volition, kind of like Ehud just got up and did the right thing. It's not a prophet, a human being that is blessed by God's voice going through them, telling Gid'on to do it. Instead, it is an angel of God, a much more direct intervention of God telling Gid'on exactly what to do. I will read it here in Judges 6. An angel of the Lord came and sat under the terebinth at Ophrah, which belonged to Joash the Abizarite. His son Gid'on was then beating out wheat inside a wine press in order to keep it safe from the Midianites. The angel of the Lord appeared to him and said to him, "The Lord is with you, valiant warrior." And at this point, Gid'on cracks. Gid'on says, "Please, my Lord, if the Lord is with us, why has all this befallen us? Where are all his wondrous deeds about which our fathers told us, saying, 'Truly the Lord brought us up from Egypt?'" Note that they do have some memory. We were led to believe that they keep forgetting, right? But we see that there is some memory. They remember the Egyptian Exodus. Except instead of giving them inspiration not to abandon God, these memories only bring bitterness because they remember those great miracles and compare them unfavorably with their present reality. I'll go back to what Gideon says. Why are all his wondrous deeds about where are all his wondrous deeds about which our fathers told us, saying, truly the Lord brought us up from Egypt. Now the Lord has abandoned us and delivered us into the hands of Midian. The Lord turned to him and said, go in this strength. This very prostration, the very fact that you speak out, not just for you, but for us. You speak up for your people. You don't just say hello to the angel talking to you, but rather you say, where is God with our nation? I care about my nation, about our people. Take that strength and go and fight with it. And he said, go in this strength of yours and deliver Israel from the Midianites. I herewith make you my messenger. Now, Gideon is not immediately convinced. He says, reading a little bit below, please, my Lord, how can I deliver Israel? Why? My clan is the humblest in Menashe, and I am the youngest in my father's household. But God sends him various signs to prove that he will really be with him. And then God does something really remarkable. After Gideon gathers a mighty troop of people, he forces them to send most of them home. I'm not going to go into the whole story of exactly how Gideon chooses who stays and who remains, but the important point is that Gideon is going into battle with these hordes and hordes of nomadic tribes that come and wash like locusts across the entire Jezreel Valley with 300 men. We're not talking already about the 10,000 men that fought with Barak. We're talking about 300 men. And the reason, God tells us the reason, it's not a secret that we have to deduce, is so that the people will know it's not their own might that saved them. It is God himself. It's as if God himself is getting frustrated. Time and time again, God saves them. And time again, somehow the stories that pass down to the children don't explain the connection that we, the readers, are privy to and are able to see between abandoning God and being abandoned by God in return. So time and time, the stories that are passed down to the children don't do the job of educating the children not to make the same mistakes. And it's almost as if God is just tearing his hair out, forgive me for the obviously sacrilegious metaphor here, and says, no, don't pass stories of, and then we fought a war and won down the line. Pass stories of, and then God saved us so that people will remember to feel gratitude. But it doesn't work. What I wanted to point out by comparing this is to show that there is a certain trend here. And the trend is that the savior, if in the beginning the savior is someone who rises perhaps with God's inspiration, but at least according to the simple words of the text, from their own volition. Slowly, slowly, as the text progresses, we see that the Savior is more and more a puppet, a tool in God's hand. Ehud rises and goes and does the job. Barak rises because a prophet tells him to do the job. Gideon rises because an angel of God speaks to him directly and tells him to do the job, and then has to poke and poke and poke him until he finally agrees. If the beginning of the book got us our hopes up that what we're watching is the moment when the Israelites are going to grab initiative and shape their own story, what we see is the progressive dissolution of this hope. They're moving away from that. There's other differences. The success of each judge is less than the success of the judge before him. Sometimes we see it in terms of the number of years that they have peace after each victory. We see it in terms of how much of the land of Israel becomes free from intrusion. We don't have time to do it all in detail. I'll just have to ask you to believe me about that. But if you read carefully, you really see that each judge is less and less their own person, more and more someone chosen and pushed by God, who becomes the protagonist of salvation instead of our partner in it, and is less and less successful. And also, and we mentioned that in passing last week, but now that we have now that we read some of the stories, we can see it better. The salvation moves farther and farther away from the purview of the tribe of Yehuda. The beginning of the book set us to expect that Yehuda is going to play an important role. And the very first judge, who happened to be a man named Otniel ben Knaz, was indeed a man of Shevet Yehuda. But the second judge, Ehud, whom we met, the man who put a sword on the wrong side or the right side of the body, is from the tribe of Binyamin. Look at the map, you'll see it's one removed from Yehuda. The next one is Dvorah, the prophetess, who is from the tribe of Ephraim. Once again, once removed to the north, if you look at the map. Then we meet Gid'on, who was from Shevet Menashe, who is, again, if you look, one tribe to the north. Eventually, we will come back. Then we will move to Iftach, who is from Transjordan, from the other side of the river. And eventually, we'll come back to Shimshon, who is from the tribe of Dan, and who is given, he's betrayed by Yehuda to the Philistines. We come a full circle. Not only is leadership slowly migrating away from Yehuda, what we're seeing is also that eventually the sons of the tribe of Yehuda fulfill a negative subjugative, so to speak, I'm sorry, submissive role in the story of our interaction with the nations around us. That, of course, sets us up to wonder how on earth the salvation of the entire story is supposed to rise from the tribe of Yehuda, and we will come back to that expectation when we meet a young man from Beit Lechem a few classes ahead. But in what I want to finish with, since our class is drawing to a close, is that there's another way that repetitions are used to make a point in the book of Judges. We spoke so far about how the repetition over time emphasizes certain common elements that come together always. We showed how the repetition creates a certain normal, thus highlighting the things that change from repetition to repetition. But there's another form of repetition. And that is the way within one story unit, sometimes you have two parallel plots, in other words, themes. In other words, storylines repeat themselves not over time as the story progresses, but in parallel to each other, highlighting and emphasizing certain aspects of each other. And this is what happens in the story I want to talk about in the little bit of time we have left, and that's the story of Iftach. Iftach, unlike Gid'on, who says he's an unimportant man, but he's still clearly a landowner, somebody who works in the land, Iftach isn't. Iftach is a bastard. He is the son of Gilad. Now, Gilad is an area. It's a whole area in Transjordan, which is a kind of a subtle way to say that, do we even know who his father is? He's the son of all of Gilad and some woman who's never named. And when he grows up, his brothers, which again could mean his actual brothers, if he knows who his father is, or the people of Gilad more in general, the legitimate sons of Gilad, people who know who they are and have family lineages and land and place in the community in Gilad, kick him out. They say, you shouldn't have part with us. You're not one of us. We're not interested in you. And he goes and lives in the wild lands, and he collects other people who are anashim reikim, empty people, people of no substance, who gather around him, and they become bandits. And then something happens. The Ammonites, who live in the same area, start oppressing the Israelites very, very severely. And the Israelites do two things. The first thing is they call to God for help. The second thing is they call to Iftach, the bandit that they abandoned and kicked out, to help. And here comes a fascinating thing. Both God and Iftach give the same answer. The story repeats itself not only consecutively, but within the same unit, within the same story. You have it in your source sheet, which I hope was sent to you. I'm not sure, but if not, I'll make sure that you, it was not sent. So I'll make sure it's sent to you after the class, but it was supposed to be sent. You have it in the source sheet. We don't have time to go over it in details now. But both God and Yiftach say, why are you coming to me now when you need me after you abandoned me? Why should I save you, me, God, or me, Yiftach, when you didn't want me, when you didn't care about me? It's almost this, as if the story of Yiftach the man is there to emphasize for us the deep sin at the heart of the ongoing cycle of Jewish suffering in the book of Judges, the sin of ingratitude, of being saved and then forgetting it again, of being saved and then worshiping idols instead of the God who saved you, of misunderstanding our debt to God. So we watch it play also in the human plane with the people's kind of boldness and asking for help from a man who only suffered in their hands. But then comes the interesting part, because here the pattern changes. If there's a repetition between the pattern of begging for help and being rebuffed, there's a divergence. Because both, because when the people come and say to God, yes, we sinned and we're sorry, but we really, really need you. Please help us. And we promise you will be our God and we will worship you. God relents and says, I will help you. When the people of Gilad come to Yiftach and say, yes, we abandoned you, you're right, but please come back and we will make you our head. We will make you our leader. We will reestablish you in the community, not as one of us, but as the highest amongst us, as the leader amongst us. We're not told, okay, he was compassionate and therefore he decided to agree, as we are told about God. Instead, he kind of doubles down, forces them to make a very strong commitment that he will indeed be their king. And he comes back clearly not as an act of compassion, but as an act of avarice, as an act of chasing power over his fellow men. And this is where the alarm should start ringing in our head, because what we're seeing here is the danger in humans in leadership positions. When we attribute power, when we give power to God, we're giving power to he who feels compassionate towards us. When we give power to men, we don't know. Sometimes they feel compassion, and sometimes, as we see in the Yiftach story, they only see us as a means to an end. The repetition doesn't end here. There's another parallel, another two storylines that come together in the Yiftach story, because Yiftach succeeds. He sets out to war and he wins brilliantly. But his success is tragic, because before he sets out to war, he makes a very hasty and ill-advised vow that the first creature to come out of his home to greet him upon his victory will be sacrificed to God. And as we know, the first creature to come out of his home upon his victory is his daughter. And he sacrifices her. Either there's a question of whether he really killed her or he just held her in isolation without letting her marry and have her own life. But in one way or another, he sacrifices her. And around the same time, suddenly the tribe of Ephraim, which as we saw is from the mainland of Israel, not from Transjordan, and is described in the story as being more important and established and seeing themselves as the local regional leaders, come to Yiftach and say, how dare you go to war without our support? How dare you go and fight Ammon without us fighting for you? We didn't say you can fight them. You should have asked us and we would have led you in war. We are the leaders here, not you, Mr. Nobody Bastard. They don't say it, but it's implied. And they say something very harsh. They say, I'm at the very last box on the page, they say in the first verse here, the men of Ephraim mustered and crossed the Jordan to Tzafon. They said to Yiftach, why did you march to fight the Ammonites without calling us to go with you? We'll burn your house down over you, which is a very painful thing. So it echoes very harshly when we know that his home, his children, his child, his daughter, was just sacrificed. He already lost his home. And now they come and say, we will ruin your home. We will burn your home on you. And Iftach responds with extreme anger, extreme force, and kills 42,000 of them, of the sons of Ephraim. In other words, both the personal home in Iftach and the national home of the Jewish people fall apart. He kills his own child or sacrifices her in some way, and he kills his own people. And this parallel, this repetition, brings home another deep point, another deep truth that the book of Judges keeps pushing towards us. And that is the fact that military victory in and of itself is not enough. Because if military victory was enough, then the book would have ended with Ehud, with Otniel ben Knaz, with Gideon, with Dvorah. We wouldn't have had the same cycle over and over and over again if victory as such was enough. Clearly, victory can't fix the deep problems of the book of Judges. Victory can't be the foundation of a home, of a bayit, be it a national home, a private home. What is a home? In the case of Iftach, we see that a home is also the relationship between parent and child. And Iftach, in a sense, is the quintessential example of the judges, of the era of the judges, because we see how he's disconnected from his parents. He's a bastard without parentage who's kicked out of his home. And then he's disconnected from his children, thus embodying the problem of this era where the truth of our covenant with God isn't passed on from parent to child. And every generation has to live through forgetfulness and sin and idol worship and enslavement over and over again. Iftach lives it physically in his own flesh, but the entire nation lives it in terms of their collective faulty memory and in terms of their tragic repetition of the same thing over and over again. And so what we see, and this is the thought I want to leave end on today, and I'll give some time. I know we're past the time, but I'll give time for questions if anybody wants to stay. But I want to finish on this thought. What the book of Judges brings home with force is that if we want to break the pattern, if we don't want to watch the same thing happen over and over again in this kind of Greek tragedy of necessity and predetermined suffering, something needs to restore the home, the connection between parents and children, between generations, between God and the people as a home together, also as a family, between the tribes as brothers. Something needs to restore that. And military victory is just not it. And the question of what it is that can restore it and how we're supposed to go about fighting it is going to be what we will see rising slowly towards the end of the book of Judges, which is what we will discuss next time. Now, I would like to thank you, first of all, and I appreciate you all being and participating. And does anybody have any questions or comments? I'll read what's in the chat, but first of all, does anybody want to speak up? So I will go back to reading. There's a lot of comments, so I'll try and do it justice. I don't know if we can delay on all of them. Moment. Lorraine Blatt points out that it started with King Solomon bringing in foreign wives and their idolatry. It came from the top. This will be true for the era of the kings, but since we're not at the era of the kings yet, we're going to wait for that. We'll get to that later. Epi wrote, the rabbis explain why we don't say Hallel on Purim, which starts in Psalm 113, that we are Avdei Hashem, by stating that we are still Avdei Achashverosh. That in Purim, I'll elaborate on that, that in Purim, the story of Purim doesn't tell us a story of a full redemption because we're still stuck in exile under the control of Achashverosh. I think what Epi is implying here is that the fact that we are the slaves of Achashverosh means that on some level, we're not fully free to be the slaves or the servants of Hashem, which is goes back to the idea that somehow by becoming idol worshippers, slaves of worship, of Dei Elilim, people who worship slaves, who give ourselves to idols, we then become enslaved to other nations, and then on some level our ability to be of the Hashem is diminished. As Susan Levine puts it succinctly, those who forget history are doomed to repeat it. Linda Heppner wrote the vital importance of teaching each generation, which is why names and families are constantly repeated. That's correct. And we will see that, we'll talk about that a lot next week, that as things start coming to a head, as the entire era comes to its tragic ending and to the kind of collapse, the crescendo collapse that requires the rise of kingship, we start losing the names. The farther down the book of Judges we are, less people are mentioned by name, but we will talk more about that next time. Just a moment. Someone pointed out that Reed Gideon and Midian, was God remembered here because God already once defeated Midian? So if God is to know to more powerful than Midian, give God the task again. Meaning, I think that the point is that because we already saw God defeating Midian once, he should defeat Midian another time. I'm not sure that that's the case, because it mentions the Egyptian exile in particular. When the angel talks to Gideon, he mentions the victory over Midian in particular. Okay. Arthur Stain wrote, in English, there is a vast difference between being a slave, which means no control over one's time and destiny, and being a servant. A servant can make choices. It is crucial not to blur this distinction. The same is true of the difference between enslavement and subjugation. The common Hebrew root confuses this issue, and it is up to us to make the distinctions from context. Thank you for this comment. This is a very good point. In Hebrew, the fact that the root is common means something, in the sense that it's not a mistake. It's not a confusion of terms. It's true that to say la'avod and eved, it's not exactly the same as mesharet, but in Hebrew, there's a certain emphasis on a connection between the two, that there's a certain aspect where when you give yourself to somebody else by giving your labor, be it the labor of your hands or the labor of your mind or your love, or your service, or your loyalty, there's a certain giving of the self that's common between servant and worker and slave, and somehow is at the core of this concept. And this is the common core that we're trying to unpack here, the sense of we are dedicated. It's about dedication. Who is it and what is it you dedicate yourself to? But thank you for bringing it up. It's an important point that I'm using these words in an interchangeable way, and I need to be more careful about that. Did you say that Bnei Israel called out to God in the days of Iftach? Where is that in the text? Thank you, Ilana Lubin. It is in, I can tell you exactly where it is right now. Chapter 10. It's in the source sheet, which again, I apologize. I don't know why you didn't get it, and I'll make sure that you get it now. Source sheet. I'll have to ask Rabbi Kalman how to pass you the source sheet. I'm not sure how to do that. Saul wrote, it seems that most of the Shoftim were not righteous, sometimes even brutish. So I wouldn't say it exactly like that, but you definitely see a certain decline in the quality of the judges. And again, that goes back to that trend of decline that I was talking about. It's not just a matter of success in their endeavors. There's definitely a certain decline in their righteousness. The first few judges that we see, Ehud ben Gera, Otniel ben Knaz, Dvorah HaNevi'ah, Gid'on, all are people who don't only lead the people to victory, but then invest themselves in educating the people and trying to recreate a sense of belonging to God. Gideon, even though he's the last in that line of righteous judges, shines through also because he rejects the people's desire for him to become king. After he wins with his 300 men, the people come and say, maybe you should be our ruler and rule over us and your children after you and your children's children after you. And he says, no way, God should rule over you. But then he does something interesting. He creates some sort of gold thing from the loot of his victory that's somehow supposed to symbolize the victory and remind people of God's root. And instead, in his children's generation, they start worshiping it. They treat it, it's almost like a golden calf. They treat it as some sort of representation of power. They treat it as something that has power in and of itself instead of a representation of the fact that God is the one who brought the victory, which was, as we said in the Gideon story, the point God was trying to make by making the army so small. So they missed the point somehow. And then from that point, we really do see a very serious decline in the quality of the judges. We meet Iftach, we meet Shimshon, a man who, if Iftach is a man moved by his desire for power, Shimshon is a man moved by his desire and lust. We can talk about that a little bit later. And then it just, the whole thing starts falling apart over our head. And on that unhappy note, I will say thank you so much for being here. If anybody wants to say something or ask another question, now is the time. I'm sorry if I somehow missed your chat message. It's hard for me to see all of them at once. So if I missed it, feel free to email through Torah and Motion, and they'll pass me your information. Thank you so much. And now that we have this ringing fact in our mind that victory in the battlefield is simply not enough, let us reconvene next week and see what might be a way out, what might lead us out of this morass of disaster, generational disasters. Thank you so much.